life's journeys and the bits of wisdom gathered along the path. This is a sketch, a perpetually unfinished portrait of a community of explorers. This is a guide to curiosity and wonder, setting off from Gainesville, Florida. This is Find a Way. Our guest this week is John David Erickson. I've only just begun my friendship with John David, but I've quickly found myself awestruck by their commitment to their passions and their practice. They are a multi-instrumentalist with an inspired relationship to the cello and bass, and they are an accomplished sound engineer, mixer, and producer. John David and I share a curiosity for life's greater mysteries, which led them to explore the depths of both Eastern and Western esoteric traditions. They possess a wealth of knowledge and a generously inquisitive method of elucidation. Enjoy what I hope will be one of many conversations with John David Erickson. Thanks for being here. I love sitting down. Like, you're somebody that I don't know super well. We've only gotten to interact in a band setting for the most part, and, you know, from a distance at Riverine a couple of times.
Yeah.
And I've seen you play a couple of times, but despite all that, immediately I kind of felt like you're somebody I could learn a lot from. You're somebody who has perspective that I don't think a lot of other people have. I think you have an intention that I don't see in everybody. And so I immediately appreciate that, and it immediately makes me very curious, makes me want to do this. So I, as I said when I first came in, I really appreciate you reaching out and hanging out with me.
Yeah, and there's like an aspect of playing music with people where like there is like a connection and intimacy forms, but like sometimes you don't really get to know the person at all anyway.
Right.
Just the way that you communicated during practices and would express gratitude and like appreciation for people. It's like, oh, Colin's like a kind of person that I would like to get to know a little bit more. So I really like those qualities in people.
Thanks. Yeah. I appreciate that too. I appreciate that on a couple different levels, and I'm realizing we're saying appreciate a lot, which is fine with me. But I know sometimes that kind of approach, I've seen it make people uncomfortable sometimes.
Yeah.
You know, that sort of like blunt, like, here's five things that I love you did today, you know,
yeah.
or things like that. And that, you know, that's too bad, I think.
Yeah.
I really cherish when somebody's able to do the same thing to me, if I'm meeting that criteria for them.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, when I do it, it just feels like something that I have to say.
Yeah.
Feels like something I can't keep in. But it's an interesting point you make, though, about playing music with people and having that intimacy with them, and yet there can be such a distance.
That's right.
I struggle with that sometimes. And again, I think I get pushback from bandmates sometimes when I'm like, we should know each other better. I should know about things in your life I want to know about.
Right.
Maybe not should.
Yeah.
But
mandatory intimacy.
That's right. That's a very good point. I'm going to use that. I like that phrase. But it's kind of like a magic, you know? It is. Yeah. It's sort of like, well, I mean, that's not a huge statement. Music certainly feels like the most palpable form of magic that I should say it's the form of magic that I feel the most involved with and maybe the most amount of control, which is very little.
Yeah.
But still, I feel as though I could call myself a practitioner in that one. Limited, but
yeah.
A practitioner.
Coming back to like how people sometimes aren't ready to receive observation of like appreciation or gratitude.
Mm-hmm.
Like I experienced that I'm trying to remember one specific thing that you said, but like when like it is fundamentally difficult, I think, for people to receive compliments.
Yeah.
And I was just listening to Tammy Simon. Are you familiar with her?
No.
Do you know the Sounds True publication from Boulder?
No.
They do like a lot of like spirituality and psychology books.
Okay.
Been around for like 40, 50 years. And so she's like been deep in like you know, her personal practices, and you know, I think she's in her 60s now, and she expressed that in an interview recently that she has a hard time receiving like appreciation from people. So I don't know, it's interesting. I think about that a lot.
Do you have the same experience?
Yeah.
I have some thoughts on what it is, but I'm curious to know where you think that comes from.
I think it's different for different people.
Sure.
I'm trying to think. Sometimes, I think as musicians, like we have access to so much great music created by all the greatest musicians that have ever been recorded.
Yeah.
So it's easy for us to compare ourselves to like people we really appreciate.
Yeah.
And we always, at least myself, like I'm like, I will always feel like I fall short of like person X and person Y and person Z. So when I receive a compliment, I'm like, why are you complimenting me? Like, I'm not as good as like this person you can look up on YouTube right now or whatever.
Yeah. Comparison is just the worst.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's an unfortunate aspect of how music has been presented to us in our age. I mean, I guess it's not our age, it's for the ages for the most part, but Lexi Braun introduced me to a quote, and I don't remember who said it, but it was a quote, and I'm going to get it wrong too, but it was basically saying, like, how sad is it that music has become a thing that people do to get good at instead of recognizing that it's a thing that all humans did just because we were made to do it.
That's right.
It's intrinsic to our nature.
That's right.
And I find myself sometimes fantasizing about like early hominids, you know, sitting around making music, and I wonder, like, was one of them looking across at the other and being like, I don't sing as well as I wish I could hit those high notes like they do.
There's like social capital that you get when you're like a great songwriter or a great,
right,
you can shred guitar, and like I bet that's always been part of like human experience.
Yeah. I wonder though if there's ever been an iteration of our culture that valued the spirit more than the sound. I mean, I think there are examples of it,
yeah,
you know, in
totally.
Modern day. I think Bob Dylan is a great example of it, even though, you know, some people might, you know, crucify me for saying so, but certainly not a traditionally beautiful sounding musician. And yet beauty comes from all directions in his songs.
Totally.
And so I wonder if that's becoming, I don't know, if that's as appreciated anymore, or if it's dwindling, or if I'm just, you know, getting old and becoming, you know, less open to.
It might be reflections of the culture too. Like, I think our culture, like Western culture, or American culture, values like individualism and like elevating ourselves above others. And I used to be really into African music.
Yeah.
And there's examples of music from, it isn't really being made anymore, as far as I know, but the Pygmy tribes, they were fundamentally like, at least historically, more anarchic in their social structure.
Right.
And music was very communal. There's these beautiful polyphonic singing that they do, if you can find recordings online. And it wasn't about elevating the individual. It was all about like the combination of the sounds, of the voices all together. And so, yeah, maybe it's just a reflection of our society, of how we have to compete against each other.
It would make sense, right? Because
yeah.
The life reflects the art, and then the art reflects life. And
yeah.
Maybe that's why it bothers me so much. I have a lot of problems with the structure of our society that I frequently grumble about, but it reminds me of something I think I mentioned in my conversation with Michael Malley a couple of weeks ago. One of my favorite recordings that I've ever been a part of was one where my friend Travis and I had just recorded a rainstorm, and then after the rainstorm, these frogs came out and started singing, you know, croaking, but singing. Mm-hmm. And it was, I just listened to it last night, actually, just on a whim. And it's such a sacred thing. You know, I part of me wants to go find the original recording we made of it so that I can only just listen to the frogs. And, you know, I did a little part over it just with a synthesizer. And I love that. I mean, it's one of my favorite things. But I would love to just sit and listen to that recording of the frogs. Just the way they interplay with each other and the way that the rhythms change. And I could just sit and wonder, like, what does it mean? What are they feeling? Why are they doing it? You know, and I'm sure I'm wrong in every answer I come up with. It's something probably beyond.
Yeah, I want to listen to that. Do you have it online or something?
I don't know if I have it online, but I will make sure that you get it. Yeah, sweet. Yeah, I will make sure you get it.
I used to be really into, like, field recordings and sound collage and stuff like that. And
yes.
I guess experimental music, for lack of a better term, but with kind of weaving in melody as well.
That reminds me of, so when you asked me earlier about field recording, and one of my favorite things that I caught was on a trip to New York City, and I was walking through Central Park and going through one of the tunnels, sort of, and somebody was playing saxophone in the tunnel.
Oh, the cool reverb.
Oh, wow. There was a second one that day in a different tunnel, and somebody had an accordion. And again, it was just, I don't know, it just sort of exists in this heightened pedestal for me in my lifetime of recording. I don't think I could, if I worked every day to try to recreate the moment and that captured, I couldn't, I don't think, obviously, but
totally.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you, I know we're talking about like a Woo Part 2 kind of thing.
Yes.
But we're on the topic of music, and this is a question I've been wanting to ask music makers that I appreciate and admire. So
thank you.
Why do you still play music, and have the reasons that you play music changed over the course of your life?
Good question. Yeah. So to answer the latter part of your question first, the reasons have changed,
yeah,
for sure. Or I'm sorry, they've changed in subtraction and addition as well. But there have been some standard reasons that have remained the same. The first reason I can think of, you know, if I go as far back as I can remember, it was just because it really felt good. I mean, my biggest association with playing my own music or wanting to play my own music is with my dad. My dad used to play guitar to me and my sister and my mom. And I just remember watching him playing and thinking, like, I got to do that. That's, I don't know what, it just brought me so much pleasure. And I can remember.
How old were you?
I mean, since my earliest memories, you know, so yeah. I'm sure, I know that he played for me as a baby, but I think I can probably remember around like 4 or 5 years old, yeah, just begging, like, play Rocky Raccoon again, aww, or play Blackbird again, or, you know, whatever it is.
Yeah.
A lot of Beatles, you know, which is probably a big reason why I have such a love for the Beatles still today.
Totally.
But yeah, watching him play, watching his fingers move, and not understanding any of it, but just knowing, like, this combination of his voice and this guitar was magic for me. It was just this, you know, happy place, more so than almost anything else that I did. And so that was the starting point. And then as I got older and my personality started interfering with fun, you know, I wanted attention. I wanted to impress people.
Yeah.
I remember when I finally, I learned how to play piano first a little bit, and I had to take lessons, and I really didn't like them. So I quit, and then I learned drums, and I love drums. And I had a really good time in a band in middle school playing drums in like a classic rock band with this phenomenal guitarist who is my oldest friend.
I knew you played drums, but I didn't know that it was that far back. That's cool.
Yeah. So I would say that was my first instrument that I felt competent at that time, at least. I look back and I think maybe not. But that was just fun. And I don't think we were even thinking about getting famous or anything like little kids do. That was just, I got a drum set for my, you know, 12th birthday, and Joe got a guitar, and then we just started jamming and added people and started playing. It was great. But the reason why I started learning guitar was I thought, like, I can't impress people just with drums by myself. You know, I gotta like, woo the girls with like a song on guitar.
And you're always
like
in
that.
The back behind everybody.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So I'll just play louder so everybody notices me. I definitely play loud. And so I remember telling my dad, just teach me Blackbird. That's the only thing I'll ever need to learn. You know, that'll be the main thing. So even I appreciate that you've prompted me to review this, because I've never considered this progression before, but I can see just in that intention that I'd lost the, you know, teach me so I can do this thing. I don't even need to know other songs, right? So I'd lost that impetus to like learn what dad did, you know, learn how he played. Yeah. I just wanted to learn this one thing that I still thought was beautiful.
Yeah.
So all that being said, college, when I had a band in college, the first one that was a real like tight knit group and was writing original music that I was proud of.
You were playing guitar at that point?
I was playing piano again.
Oh, okay.
And that's why I picked up piano again when I, you know, at the end of high school or so. And when I got to college, I met this guy, Tim, in my dorm, and he was writing music, and I was just so impressed by it. And so he encouraged me and kind of helped me along the way to learn how to write songs. And so I would say that was an addition that still stays today, which is like friendship and camaraderie.
Yeah.
I remember feeling such a strong connection with those guys. I was my friend Tim and Jake and Steve, and I remember having that moment of knowing what they were going to do while we were jamming, you know, and that being such a new thing for me. It's just like a sensation that I just thought that was like maybe my first little flash of experience with this magic I'm talking about. Yeah. Like, oh my God, you know, are we reading each other's minds? Are we, you know?
Totally.
And having people really invest time and effort and thought into a thing that I made. You know, I'd come to them and I'd say, I've got this little bit here, here's this and here's that. Oh man, we could do this and I'll do a solo here and what if we change the chord here? And like just sitting there in a room with three other people, my peers, who were, I don't know, like they could have saved all that creative juice for themselves. They could have gone and done their own things, but they wanted to like share. And man, what a thrill. What a gift to give that to somebody and then put your ego on the line, you know, go up on stage and then do it in front of all these people and put your names on an album together and all that stuff. So that I think is something that I still hold on to today. And at some point there is this brief period of thinking like, we're going to get famous.
Oh yeah.
We're going to make it and wanting it, you know, wanting that like thing and getting a little full of myself and getting a little like, you know, we bring out 400 people to a show this week and you know, all that goofy stuff.
Yeah.
And thankfully that didn't happen. Thankfully, I mean, it fell apart in a way that really destroyed me. And thankfully, it in all the destruction, it took a huge chunk of my ego with it. And I had a good like 10 years of looking at that time and thinking, man, what a dick I was. What a, I must have sounded like such a jerk to people who were on the outside of it. And really it took a lot of, like build up again to write songs and to present them to people and things like that.
But it took you like 10 years to get back.
I would say 10 years to get back to a point where I felt like what I made mattered, but not in the same way. I thought it mattered back then because like these songs are going to be in the charts, you know?
And, yeah.
But I would say it was probably my early to mid 30s before I got my mind wrapped around the idea that like these songs matter because they're a gift, you know, this is me, you know, or it's not me actually. It's just, I got a gift and now I get to show it to you. And that feels way more important than getting famous, you know, and getting famous actually sounds like a nightmare. Yeah. So another addition to this question or to this reason is that music kind of saved me, kind of helped me get out of it, even though it got me in there. It's like this mischievous little trickster who leads you into the cave and you get lost in the cave. And then it's like, well, okay, I'll show you out again here. And you end up on the other side of the mountain. And, I think that made me really fall in love with it to a point that I didn't understand before. I thought I was in love with it before.
Oh, that's interesting.
But it's kind of like a superficial love, you know? And now it's like I'm a lifelong lover of it. You know, I don't want to exist without it. So I have that now today, and I find myself sort of in our situation, you know, where now I find myself meeting new people and creating these deep connections. That's one of the things that I really loved when you and I got to play in Vim together. It's right off the bat, you came in and you had parts written out and you had ideas about the song structure and you had ideas about, I could just immediately, I had this picture in my head of you working and you caring and seeing the importance of it, not just because it's you playing in the band, but because this is Jacob's project that he cares a lot about and he cared to ask you to be in it. And so you're going to show like, okay, well, I'm not going to just half-ass this. I'm going to do a really good job with this. And
totally.
So so many reasons. I feel like I just like rambled there.
No.
It was a wonderful little road to go down that I don't think I've ever investigated.
I think we're about the same age. I'm 42.
Yeah, 41.
So we've had long enough lives that there is like a little bit of a narrative to tell.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Especially with something like music.
Yeah, yeah. It's like a central part of our like identity, probably. At least it is for me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you have like, you know, solid connection to a reason throughout your life as well? Is it
let me think. It has changed over time. When I was little, it was the 80s, so
yeah.
I lived in South America, but all the music I listened to like on the radio was like Michael Jackson and like Madonna and stuff.
Yeah.
And my dad listened to Paul Simon and Prince. I lived in Ecuador and, my dad worked for Texaco. So, Texaco gave us money for me to go to a private school. So I was able to play cello early on.
Yeah.
I only picked the cello because it was like big.
I love the cello.
And there was a kid in my bus that I thought was cool that would walk into the bus with a cello. I was like, I want to be cool like that.
Yeah,
kid.
Yeah, yeah.
I played like a version of Twinkle Twinkle after a year, and then we ended up moving here,
back
to Florida in 1991. So I stopped playing cello until middle school. But with cello, until I started getting into like writing original music on it, it was just like a thing that I had to do, which is what classical music felt like to me.
Yeah.
I played in like community orchestras and I took lessons. I wasn't super dedicated. Like later on, I realized that like dedicated classical musicians, they try to practice 4 hours a day.
Yeah.
And I was like, I never practice anywhere near that. Maybe not even 4 hours a week. and I could tell that my cello teacher was kind of like encouraging me, but kind of like could see I wasn't making much progress. And there was like a certain like attitude. She would never said anything mean or anything, but there was just something kind of like, I don't know, disappointed or something in her behavior. And
I know what you mean.
And so that affected me.
Yeah.
But then, yeah, I lived in Central Florida in Sebring. I don't know. A lot of people don't know where that is, but it's about 3 hours south of Gainesville, a little bit farther. And there really wasn't anything to do because it's like a retirement community / like agricultural area.
Mm-hmm.
But there was a local musician that like heard through people that I play the cello, and he played hardcore music and he was trying to get into acoustic music.
That's cool.
And so he became sort of like my mentor in like learning to play music for fun.
Wow. Yeah.
and that he was like my first like connection I made through music, and then from that point forward, I did continue classical music. I played at in the UF orchestra a couple of maybe 2 or 3 years, but from that point forward, like music became like a central focus of my life, and like I've met like 90% of the people that I know through music.
Yeah, same here.
Maybe they're not musicians, but they come to shows or whatever.
The music community is a lot wider than musicians. You know, yeah. I think that's a common misconception that a lot of people have. Yeah.
Yeah. I've met like some of my favorite music lovers are like the music super fans that aren't really musicians.
Right.
But they have like a huge record collection and they love to go to shows and they're always like discovering new music and yeah. And I feel like it's like a slightly like a tangent, but sometimes I feel like I listen to music as like a to learn it.
Sure.
rather than to enjoy it.
I know
so
you
it's
mean.
Nice to be around people that would be more like a DJ rather than a musician or something.
Yes.
But yeah, so I definitely recognize that music was like for me like a big way to have like a social dimension. But also for me, like I actually don't really like to play shows that often. I could be very satisfied playing one show a month. For me, it's like the solitary act of creating music, of just experiencing like the physical act of making it,
mm-hmm.
and then also like growing into different techniques and different ways to perform it and deepen different aspects of musicianship is really, really rewarding.
Yeah.
And then I like bringing that solitary effort with other people who are like on the same path.
Right.
And then kind of cross-pollinating, inspiring each other, listening to each other. That's really rewarding for me.
The cross-pollination part is fascinating to me.
Yeah.
Just in self-reflection, even just seeing how I change based on who I'm with. That's one of my favorite things about saying yes to bands that, you know, that might reach out to me to play that weren't what I considered my style.
Yeah.
I think one of the first times I did that was with Samantha Jones with Cassette. She reached out to me way back, I don't know when, 2010-ish or 2011. And
I didn't know that it was that far back.
Yeah, yeah. I think, I mean...
Were you in an early iteration of the group with, what's a violin player that lives in Asheville now with Mark?
Oh yeah, Mark, yes.
And there was a cellist and a bassist too.
So Mark played cello.
Okay.
And then our friend Amy played violin.
Okay.
And Kay Flo was our drummer.
With a baseball cap?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think I remember seeing a version of that at the Atlantic.
Yeah. Yeah. We had a lot of fun. And again, it's a cross-pollination of many things. You know, it was a culture and friend circle that I knew of but wasn't in, yeah. You know, and so I found myself surrounded by new interesting people who so totally changed my way of thinking in many ways just because I'm around them and listening to them and talking to them.
Yeah.
But the music too, I remember going in and just kind of thinking like, what am I gonna do for this, and then playing and thinking like, oh, I can come up with some weird shit here. Yeah, you know. I'm like, and Sam was the same way. She was so encouraging to change the song, do what you want, you know.
That's cool.
I'm always really impressed with songwriters who bring in musicians and tell them, have at it, you know, do whatever you want or something like that.
Yeah.
And then maybe give you a little direction here and there, you know. Jordan Burchell does that in his band. He's very good about sort of saying like, well, here's the three things that I want, and then everything else, you know, you do. Or if you want to ask, I'll tell you.
Yeah. But I think that's the best way to do it. Like, I've never really been much of a songwriter, but I remember being like 18 or something and working on a song and like having learned enough theory that I could basically write everybody's parts.
Right.
And I told my bandmates that. That didn't go over well.
Right. It doesn't. That was the first time I made a solo album. I wanted to write all the parts and I didn't have a band. So it was, you know, it was just me in the studio doing all the parts, and I had all the songs recorded, and then it was time to put together a band to play the album.
Yeah.
And I remember going into it and being like, you're not playing that part right. It goes like this. Like, and what about, you forgot the pause here, and you guys can, you know, and it drove me crazy. And like I was gripping that way too tightly.
Yeah.
And I realized like a month after the band kind of defunct, I don't think I've ever used that as a verb before, but about a month after, I thought like, oh my gosh, duh, of course. I should have just shut up about all that stuff.
Yeah.
Especially when like some of them were writing better parts than what I wrote, and I was like, ah, man, I wish I had talked to them before I recorded the album. You know?
Yeah, totally. Yeah, there is one thing that has changed though. Like, I used to have this like deep need to like be seen by my community
right.
through music, especially when I was younger in my early 20s, and I hadn't really fully understood like the way I relate to like to people and to groups of people. I felt like very isolated and alone and like small, and I wanted to. I had this vision of like, I don't know. I was really into like really heavy dark metal and stuff like that. I wanted to be like a singer in a hardcore band or something, you know, something very, very like energetic or something like that.
Yeah.
That would get a lot of attention. But that's something that definitely has like more faded over time. And for me now, when I do play shows, like my favorite thing is to like, I like playing jazz because like the shows are two or three hours long, like multiple sets.
Yeah.
And so that high that I get after a half hour set is like quadrupled or sextupled when I play background music gigs. I love like playing for like I actually don't like playing for an audience in a very formal setting where everybody's like sitting and looking.
Oh, okay.
Because I've been in audiences like that, and then I start feeling antsy, but then I feel like I don't have the freedom to get up and move around.
Yeah.
And I'm like, is half the audience experiencing that right now? And maybe sometimes they are, because you're looking at and they're looking at their phones.
Right.
I would rather people be comfortable, be allowed to move around, and if they really want to listen, they're going to listen, and if they don't want to listen, they're going to leave. And there's something so genuine about that. So I like feeling really connected to a genuinely appreciative audience.
Yeah. What do you think about? I was talking with Sterling about the intention behind like the listening room shows where you go in and you kind of agree that you're going to quiet down for the music.
Yeah.
And I think he has a good point in that when I go into a venue where there's music playing, if I'm not thinking about, if somebody doesn't kind of give me the impetus to quiet down and listen, I might distract myself. Right. Mm-hmm. And then sometimes but when I find myself in a show like a listening room show, or when I go to the Heartwood inside room stage, because it feels like I should be quiet, I can feel myself kind of shift into a different mode.
Yeah.
I say this feeling a conflict because I very much identify with what you're talking about, with this feeling of, I'm trapped here. I can't get up and go. That's why I'm noticing in my recollection that I almost always sit in the back so that if I need to get up, I can just go and I'm not going to disturb anybody.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think, I think that there's certain contexts where that like attentive audience is important, and it's specifically like singer songwriters where right. they're expressing something they feel, something with genuine feeling behind it, and they're expressing it in a song.
Yeah.
And then having that fall on an audience that's distracted and moving around and noisy and eating and on their phone, that sucks.
Right. I don't like that. Yeah.
And and the thing about me personally is I have like a blindness in music, like my sensitivity to music is like the overall structure, the bass line, the timbre. And I don't think it's necessarily because I have an analytical mindset. It's just like the way I hear music. Mm-hmm. I have to really concentrate to catch what people are saying when they're singing.
So do I.
So for me, I almost never go to see solo singer songwriters because unless their guitar parts are like really compelling in some way, that doesn't have to be flashy. It could be just like a really solid rhythm and the timbre of their voice is really interesting. And the note choices are really interesting. It's like not the music for me because I just don't have the sensitivity for words.
I think there's a song that was put out back in the, I'm going to guess at a couple of things in this. Mm-hmm. I believe it was back in the 70s, and it was by a band that was Northern European. I don't know what language or what culture it was exactly, but the whole song was just gibberish, but it was supposed to sound like English. And the goal was to show that, like, if it sounds like it's an American song and it's got some like backbeat to it, it's going to get popular. Yeah. You know, and cool. It's a very enjoyable song, and as I listened to it, I thought, I think sometimes when I'm listening to somebody speak my own language, this still probably is about what I hear, because I'm so tuned into, like what you were saying, like I'm so tuned into the beat and the melody itself. And both Audrey and I, my partner Audrey and I, frequently have experiences where we'll look at lyrics written out and say, oh, this is what the song is about. Oh my gosh. You know? And then we have friends, our friend Liz can sit at a live show and hear a song for the first time and then recite the lyrics back to you and say, oh, well, what about that one part where they said A, B, and C? And I didn't hear that at all.
That's so interesting.
Yeah.
And both you and, is it Aubrey or Audrey?
Audrey.
Both you and Audrey are such good singers. Like, I would think that, like...
Thank you.
That you would be more sensitive to vocals, to lyrics. Right. But I guess, okay, I'm not like the oddball of who I thought I was.
She's much better at learning lyrics and remembering them once she learns them.
Okay.
If you ask anybody who's been in a band with me where I sing, they'll tell you that forgetting lyrics is second nature to me.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cool. Hmm. Yeah. So... I guess that covers it for me. Let me think if there's anything else.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah, it's just, I think for me it's just definitely like the how much pleasure I get out of playing music on my own.
Yeah.
Like, it's like a biological need. Like, I've had students that struggle to practice.
Yes.
I struggle to not practice.
Right.
And to the point where I have like all kinds of chronic pain issues and stuff that that come from it. So
The pain of love.
Yeah, that's right.
I kind of have fluctuations. I go through times where I can't get through a day without sitting at the piano and those are good times. I would say I'm in a huge ebb as far as playing every day. And as soon as I get back into it, as soon as like whatever needs to click in me to make me sit back down every day and play, as soon as I start doing it, it's one of those moments. I have a moment where I think, what was I thinking? Like, why didn't I do this? Why, you know, this is so much better. And, it's so cathartic, especially singing for me. Like I love sitting down at my piano and losing thought. Just it's funny because I can forget chords, I can forget chord progressions and things like that, but there's a moment where I can like kind of tune in. It's almost like transcendental, almost, and I'm not thinking about the chords and I'm playing all the right chords. And and I'm not thinking about the words, but I'm singing all the right words. Or if it's something that I've never played before, somehow I'm finding chords that work and somehow the words are all coming together. And I used to be really tempted to record every time I would sit down to do something like that, because I thought, oh, I got to capture you know, whatever happens. And it felt as though it kind of violated it. Kind of felt as though I was breaking a rule or something. And so I stopped doing that. And I did notice a change. I noticed it happened more often. And I would finish. Sometimes I'd cry while I was doing it. Sometimes I would just, like, laugh hysterically at the end. Or I don't know what it is, but I would get these, like, incredible emotional responses within myself. And damn, I mean, why wouldn't I do that every day? why not, you know, experience that?
Is that something that you, like, sit down to do, or you're working on something else and you kind of, like, veer off into it and that's what you need in the moment?
Both. Yeah. There are, especially if I'm feeling an intense emotion, if I'm really stressed out or if I'm lost or discombobulated, I'll think, like, oh, okay, I'm gonna go sit down and just really let it out. And like what you said, there are times where I think I have a purpose and I'm practicing a song I need to play at the end of the week, and then I'll kind of throw my hands up, ugh, and I'll just go, and that's really fun too.
That makes me think that, like, a lot of my practice, I mostly play jazz music now. It's such a, like, demanding genre, because it's like multiple genres over many decades, and there's such high levels of musicianship that I don't give myself the time to, like, just improvise, and which I used to do a lot more so on the cello. I started, like, harshly judging myself as, like, oh, you're just noodling, you need to stop noodling and practice your augmented scales or whatever. And so it just makes me think that I should, I don't know, cultivate time for that more.
I think there's room. I think there should be room for both. I definitely should do more mechanics. Yeah. I make so many flubs that could be avoided. And there are times where, if I'm just playing by myself, there are times where I feel as though the flubs are part of the spice and it's just what I'm bringing to it. There are other times where it's not needed, especially if it's in the recording studio. Yeah. We're paying for time. You know, I don't need to be making flubs like that.
Yeah.
So mechanics help me. And that's the thing, too. Mechanics help you go into that place sometimes. You know, like, that's the more muscle memory you've got, the easier it is to let go.
Absolutely. Yeah. You don't want to be thinking about music theory when you're trying to go for something.
Right.
Yeah.
For sure. Yeah. In that way, I mean, I think it kind of connects to what, you know, the impetus for us getting together was to kind of discuss more Wu and our own experiences with it and things like that. And I do find myself sometimes thinking, maybe not, like, very seriously or not in a way that I want to write a book about it, but I feel as though a lot of the practices that I have in music are very comparable to practices that I've read about that people do for their own spirituality or their own connection to, you know, a higher self or a higher knowing or whatever it is. It does tend to come to those who regularly access, who regularly put time and effort and thought. And the more you do it, the more natural it feels to go right into it. You know, I found that with meditation. When I started doing transcendental meditation, the first year or so, I would say that there were many times where I thought, am I doing this right? Am I, you know, like, what's the deal here? And now that it's been, I don't know, 4 or 5 years, It's so quick. It's so, you know, I can lose it. And there's been, you know, a month here and there where I think, well, what's going on? Where is it gone? But for the most part,
like, you mean you're not practicing?
Not where I'm not practicing, but when I sit down to meditate, my thoughts are still, just going everywhere, and I have trouble calming and kind of finding that quiet place. Even though, you know, it's okay for thoughts to come, but
that's right.
The goal is to find a quiet place, you know, here and there, and then return and return and return.
Yeah, I think for me, like, if I sit down to meditate, and I catch myself not being fully present with some kind of sensation or mantra once in that session, it's like, all right, that's great.
Yeah, that, exactly. Yes, I did it.
Yeah.
I sometimes catch myself with a timer in my head, you know, and I'll think like, you know, okay, if it's been 10 minutes, that means I still have 10 or 15 minutes to try to get there. You know, yeah. Maybe I could do it. And then other times it just feels like I just kind of ease into it and it's there and it's as it should be. I mean, I guess it always is as it should be, but yeah. It's as I think it should be.
How did you get into meditation, and was there a period of time where you're like, I don't want to do that, that's not for me?
Yeah. I've always been interested in it, but I've always been hesitant to take a class or to pay, you know, somebody to teach me. And so throughout my life, there were many times where I thought like, well, I can do this. All you got to do is close your eyes and clear your mind and easy peasy, you know, and obviously wouldn't do it. And I didn't do it consistently. I didn't, you know, the practice wasn't there. So I finally got into it and got some proper training about a year or two after Audrey and her mom took the class. So they were doing it, and at that point I had that resistance that you're talking about. I was kind of like, ah, come on, I don't need to do that. You know, and the practice that we do, you do 20 or so minutes in the morning and 20 or so minutes in the evening. And immediately I thought, 40 minutes a day, come on, I can't spare that much time. I got things to do. I gotta get moving, you know. But I saw them shift, and I saw them experience some of the benefits of it. And Audrey was really good about sort of gently encouraging me again, like, you should do it. It's worth it. We can, you know, we'll put aside some money for you to get your, you know, some training. And
yeah,
it was, so glad I did. Do you is it TM that you do?
No. So my first meditation was inspired by reading about Buddhism.
Mm-hmm.
And then, so I had a period, so I've lived in Gainesville most of my life now, but I had a period where I went to Salt Lake City.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd finished my master's in computer engineering, and it was my first like well-paying job. I had a partner, and we just got a dog, and I was living in a nice house, but I was like the least happy I had ever been in my life. I had like a lot of people, I had a lot of resistance to going to therapy. But my partner was like, you should go to therapy. Like, my partner was a psychologist. I was like, okay, yeah, maybe I should. Okay. And like, the therapist recommended acceptance and commitment therapy.
Mm-hmm.
He recommended a workbook. And I filled out like the first four pages of the workbook. And it was like tremendous relief. Because like I had never really done anything mildly therapeutic other than like distracting myself or doing music because it felt cathartic, or exercising. And so just beginning to like tend to that side of myself just felt like tremendous relief. Simultaneously with that, I've mentioned that I have chronic pain. So I've had chronic pain mostly from my desk job since like 2005. So coming on 20 years. And my partner had recommended this like mindfulness-based stress reduction, like audio lecture, I don't know how to describe it. Jon Kabat-Zinn developed mindfulness-based stress reduction, which is like he took like meditation practices from Buddhism because he's a practicing Buddhist, and he ran them through scientific tests and determined that yes, people that have chronic illnesses and yes, that people that have chronic pain can benefit from meditation. So I got these two secular forms of mindfulness, and then I was like, well, what are these inspired by? And I traced it back, and they're both inspired by practices coming out of India, specifically Buddhism. And simultaneously with that, like this sort of crisis point in my life, like basically like achieving some kind of professional and like educational goal that I've been reaching, trying to reach forward, trying to reach to since I was a little kid. Like I had achieved it and I was really miserable.
Yeah.
I was like taking stock and realizing, well, I'm an engineer. I've been trained on how to do things, but not why to do them. Mm-hmm. So I just did like a little survey of like, I need to do a survey of like philosophy. So I got like these little booklets, these little illustrated books. Like one was Western philosophy, one was Eastern philosophy. And I found that the Western philosophy was like very conceptual and like it didn't really stir anything for me. It didn't really touch anything for me. But the Eastern philosophy, like when I saw that Buddhism was like based around like understanding the nature of suffering, I was like, yes. Oh, I have that. You know?
Yeah.
And so I continued that survey, and I like doing like broad high level surveys of a field. And so I found a book that there was like a survey of what is Buddhism? What are all the different ways that it expressed? And this goes into like something you touched on with your friend Darby, where there's like an element of like feeling ashamed or something to like, I don't know, like to start thinking about things that are like not mundane, not everyday, like I had to find a path into Buddhism that was like compatible with like my very scientific materialist
yes.
mindset,
research based.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And there's Buddhism that has like a lot of magic to it and a lot of like, spiritual beings and this and that, like Tibetan Buddhism, for example. And like, that wasn't for me, but Zen Buddhism, I think, appeals to a lot of Westerners because it's like, it can be completely compatible with like a purely scientific materialist mindset.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the path I went down, and that's I learned meditation from the Zen tradition.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's such an important point to make is for you, but for many people and me as well, it really helped me. So when I took my TM training, which was short. I mean, it wasn't, it only was about a month or so.
How many classes was that, by the way?
It was different. It was during the pandemic. So oh, okay. it was a little different than usual. So I think we crammed a lot into a short amount of time. So I was doing online for most of it. And I would say it was probably twice a week or so, and it was on weekends.
Okay. There were a lot of folks that were developing spiritual practices during the pandemic, so it seems yeah. like maybe you were one of those.
Definitely. Yeah. And I'd kind of, as we discussed once before, I was delving into other odd things during the pandemic as well, sort of like given permission to.
That's when you were getting into UFOs.
Yeah.
Sweet.
And sort of indulging in some of those questions that I just let sit as questions and still do actually. Yeah. But one of the things I noticed in those trainings is that they spend the teachers are trained to spend the vast majority giving research-based evidence for why this works, you know,
yeah.
and just giving you. Almost trying to dispel the stigma from the start, you know?
Yeah.
And it reminds me a lot of when you sit down to talk to somebody about the woo stuff and you want to say like, listen, I know this sounds kind of kooky.
That's right.
But you know, there's research. I just had a conversation today where I was like, listen, there's government documents about this. Don't trust me. Go look it up, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah,
'cause
yeah.
it's such a murky, pool to be in, you know, when I think we're taught so quickly to be, it's okay to be skeptical or at least to be critical.
Yeah.
But I believe that we're kind of encouraged to be almost nasty in our skepticism yeah. about these things.
Like the Richard Dawkins style of atheism or something.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. Just the scientific materialist bias
yes.
that it is really nasty.
Yeah.
And there's, I don't know, there's an element of like fear or something in it, I think.
Definitely. Most definitely. Yeah.
I started getting into the Western esoteric tradition during the pandemic. And that's like there's some stuff in that that's like super out there.
Yeah.
And I felt, I remember this like sick feeling of shame when I told my therapist that I was getting into it.
Yeah.
And like my, my best friend at the time. And I could see in their, I was expressing that to them. And I don't know what I wanted from them, but I could see in their expression that they didn't like seeing that in me.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I did the same thing.
Yeah.
I told my therapist, and thankfully she was very encouraging, you know, and or sort of at least, I don't even know if she was into the same stuff I was talking about, but I, she was making the effort to show like, it's okay. Like,
yeah,
you know, are you like going to pack up your stuff and move to some place to, you know, fulfill your destiny? Or are you just reading this stuff and kind of curious? Yeah. And okay, yeah. I think we're good.
Yeah. Totally.
That was very helpful.
Yeah.
Tell me, so tell me about it. I'm okay. So curious. I'm so curious to hear your experience.
So, I got into Buddhism like 2011 or so, mm-hmm. and I got way into it. Like I was like almost like evangelizing it in a way.
This concludes the first half of my conversation with John David. I think this half of the conversation stands on its own, and it's a perfect place to pause and reflect. The next half of our conversation delves into John David's curiosities and studies into the occult, esotericism in general, and it is fascinating. I want to dispel some potential biases or misconceptions some of the listeners might have. A lot of people, when they hear the term occult, mostly hear the word cult, and so therefore are turned off by it or, you know, kind of weirded out by it. The word occult simply means hidden or secret, mostly hidden. And occult is a part, the occult is a part of most, if not all, religious traditions. There is occult in Judaism, in Islam, in Christianity, in, I mean, you name it. There are hidden traditions, hidden practices, hidden beliefs in all of these things. There are hidden beliefs, practices, and traditions outside of religions as well. So really, the study of the occult is simply the study of what is hidden in human culture. And so that in itself, I think, is undeniably interesting, at least to me. And so that's really what we discuss. John David has a keen mind and an avid curiosity for this topic, and I benefited greatly from our discussion. We explored some wonderful ideas and asked some questions that led us down some fascinating pathways. So I think you're going to enjoy it. I certainly did, and I am craving more still, even weeks after sitting down with them. So go on over to the next episode, give it a try, see what you think, and then let us know what you think about it. Let us know if you've got any feedback, if you've got any ideas with it, and any questions about it, and maybe we can answer some of those questions the next time I sit down with John David Erickson. So I hope you enjoyed the episode. Thank you so much for listening. Tune in on the next episode. Thank you very much. Enjoy.